This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Joe Kwan is known as the cellist who plays standing up when he performs with the Avid Brothers. His exuberant onstage persona has made him an important member of the band in the past decade. But Joe was never the kind of kid who dreamed of becoming a rock star. He began playing the cello when he was 9 years old and spent much of his childhood piously practicing his scales, hoping one day to become a professional classical cellist. As a teenager, he went to Private Arts Academy in California to continue to master his talent. But a few years later, everything ground to a halt. He didn't get into any college music programs and had to put his lifelong dream on hold. Joe moved home to North Carolina, studied computer science at UNC Chapel Hill, started a career as a consultant for IBM, but his friends kept prodding him to get back to the cello. He did, and through many twists of fate, Joe was invited to record with the Avid Brothers on their album Emotionalism. The next year, they invited him on tour, and he's been playing with the band ever since. They traveled around the world and recorded 4 full albums together. Joe is based in Raleigh when he's not on tour, but he joins me now in the studio. Joe Kwan, welcome to State of Things. Nice to have you here.
Thank you so much. This is exciting.
Well, take us back to those early years, long before the Avid Brothers. Tell us about your family, where you were born, where they were from. Tell us about those early years.
Sure. I was born in South Korea in a small harbor town in the northern part of South Korea called Incheon. Where my family was from and lived. They had a very interesting coming together. My mom and my dad come from two different classes in Korea. And it was very chance meeting that they did end up together. And at first was a bit difficult for my mother's mother to stomach because it was a very drastic class. You know, my father's side was from a very poor farming town and had very little money. And my mother's side, her father was a headmaster of a school and so grew up very affluent. And I just recently learned this story because we went to the beach with my family the day after my wife and I got married. Because my father has fallen ill, and my wife was prodding my mom about this story about how my parents got together. So this is all news to me when my mom told me this.
Did you not know anything? Wow, tension in the family. How difficult was it?
It was bad. When they first got married, my mom and my dad were so poor they didn't have any food to eat, and my grandmother and grandfather lived next door, and she refused to give them money for food because of this was not the wedding that they wanted. Obviously, these things all came around and everything was fine in the end, but it's just something that I learned. I was like, Mom, nope, you never told me this. You know, like, how is this coming out to my wife who just decided to ask the question?
Well, she asked and you didn't. But you can also imagine that this might not be a story they want to tell around.
Probably not, but at the same time, I'm like, we're still family. We're still
What brought them to the U.S. then?
So we moved to the States in 1981. Back in the day, the U.S. wanted to bring in immigrants that were doctors, you know, people who could help in many ways. And my uncle was a doctor. And my aunt and uncle immigrated to the States, I don't know what year, but in 1981, they hosted us to move here. So we moved to Trinity, North Carolina, which very few people in North Carolina even know where Trinity, North Carolina is, but it's next to High Point, and it's in Archdale.
And how old were you?
I was 1 year old at that point. 1 and a half, because that counts back then.
So what did they do for a living then?
So they came to the States and quickly set up shop on South Main Street, owning a laundromat, like a lot of immigrants did. You did what you had to put food on the table, and they opened a laundromat near Archdale. They opened the one on South Main Street in High Point. And at the time, the furniture market was a big deal. Twice a year, they would be getting all sorts of businesses from the hotels in downtown High Point. And my family ended up meeting a lot of these furniture makers, you know. So it was kind of an interesting childhood to have an Italian leather couch maker come to our house and cook Italian food for us.
Cook Italian food as you cooked Korean food, or your parents did. Yeah. And that became an important part of your upbringing, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It was always a big part of our, you know, time together as a family, because my parents, being immigrant workers, worked 12 hours, 14 hours a day, and were very rarely home. And the only time that they were was around the dinner table. That was the only time that we got to spend as a family together. But not only that, because we're an immigrant family and the population of Korean families was very low in Trinity, North Carolina, as you can imagine, we would have all of our cousins meet, aunts and uncles, cousins, everyone would meet once or twice a week, Friday or Saturday, at one of our houses.
How big was your extended family in North Carolina?
Man, I would say by 88, we had, if you included all the kids and everything, it's like 20 of us.
Wow.
So,
and you're meeting regularly, and it's
regularly,
all over good food, right?
Exactly. It was, the most important thing was the family was together. It was something that was pounded into our heads from an early age. You know, my grandparents wanted to make sure the family stayed together. Family's always together. And a byproduct of that was the cooking that came from Korea, because there were no Korean restaurants in Trinity, North Carolina, as you can imagine, was all done by my aunts and uncles, you know, and every family seemed to have a specialty.
And that'll keep them coming back.
No
whatever
doubt.
Else is going on in the family. Right. Yeah, the food's... So when did you start playing cello?
I started playing cello when I was 9, forced into it in a lot of ways. Forced into it, fell in love with it immediately.
Really?
Yeah. At age 9, I already knew after my first lesson that I wanted to be a cellist.
Wow.
Yeah. Of course, I had no clue. I just thought, you know.
Well, but I mean, the conventional, you know, sort of the take on it is if you force, especially at that age, you start to hate it and maybe later would come around to it. What was it about that instrument that you think, how did you fall in love with it, especially since it was not by choice originally?
Yeah. You know, I had to play the piano when I was about 3 because my mom made me, and that lasted probably a week. I don't remember. I was 3. I remembered hating it. But when I turned 9, you know, just being taken to a lesson without having any idea, and this cello teacher, Ruby Wenzel, was so caring and loving and just presented the cello in a way that I could understand, and it made all the sense in the world. And it felt right, you know. It's as if I could play it without being taught how the instrument was supposed to be played, and probably play about the same ability now.
I'm not so sure. I'm talking to Joe Kwan today on the State of Things. He plays with the Avid Brothers, a kind of punk rock indie alt Americana band. Everybody has a hard time trying to define it, but high energy is one thing everybody agrees with. Before we get you on stage with them, I want to talk a little bit more about your development as a cellist. Pretty soon you saw Yo-Yo Ma for the first time, right?
Yeah. I was probably 10 or 11 when I first saw Yo-Yo. And, of course, kind of blew the doors wide open as to what I imagined a cello could do or sounded like. I was in Greensboro, North Carolina, and I was told to go backstage afterwards to meet Yo-Yo. And I was a kid, so I just assumed that, yeah, that's what you do at a concert. Yeah. You go backstage and you meet the artist. So I met him, and then years later got to play for him at UNC for a master class.
Well, there's a story about that encounter, though. You didn't just meet him. Did you get to visit his cello as well?
I did. So he was visiting with several people back there, a lot of kids and families, I'm sure folks he knew in the area. And being a kid and having zero hang-ups on asking any question, I was like, hey, can I see your cello? You know, he's like, oh, yeah, it's in the dressing room. Just go on in by myself, you know, with my mom and I believe a fellow cellist at the time. And I remember just opening the case up. It had this silk bag over it. You know, it was sitting in a silk bag, and I took the silk bag off. I plucked the strings and Yeah, it was amazing. Yeah.
So what was it you're listening? As you said, you took to it. You felt you could play it readily. You felt you were made for each other. And the repertoire, classical music, had you been listening to that? Was that a...
Yeah. That's all I was allowed to listen to, I guess. I didn't even realize that I wanted to listen to other music because I truly enjoyed classical music. You know, I remember from an early age, my dad around Christmas time would always play Handel's Messiah. It was the big piece of the year. And I quickly came to love the piece, even though I had to hear it every year.
Right.
And then it was, you know, Bach and then Beethoven symphonies, and just blew the doors open with opera, you know. The three tenors, that was a big thing back in the 80s.
Yeah.
So I absolutely loved listening to classical music, and that's all I knew until I was about 16. And then I was like, oh.
There's something else.
What is this Nirvana? What is this band?
We'll talk about that transformation and a later transformation that led Joe Kwan to the Avett Brothers. And that conversation will continue on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio, talking today with Avett Brothers cellist Joe Kwan. Been playing with the band since 2006 and is featured on their last four full-length albums. Does touring with them as well. But you were talking about your family growing up near High Point, and your grandmother was really important to you. She spent a lot of your parents, as you said, your mother and father were very busy with the business, and your grandmother really had a lot of responsibility for bringing you up.
Absolutely. Grandmother and my sisters. My sisters are 7 and 10 years older than me, so they had an equal part in raising me. But my grandmother was my primary caretaker from an early age. One of the most loving and beautiful people you would have ever met. Made sure that I was fed, made sure I practiced. And there's this great picture in the High Point newspaper back in the day where this photographer caught my grandmother and I walking down the driveway, because she would always walk the half mile down our driveway to meet me when I was coming home from school and taking the bus home. And she would always meet me at the end of the driveway and walk me back. And this photographer, which if anyone from that newspaper is listening, I would love that photograph. but it's this most amazing picture of her holding my hand, and we're just walking down this dirt road, you know.
Was she the one who did most of the cooking?
She did most of the cooking while I was home, like my daily meals, breakfast, lunch. My mom would get home and make dinner with my grandmother after that. But, yeah, she did make a lot of food for me.
Did she ever express any aspiration for you, what you think, what she would like to see you become?
No.
Yeah.
She just loved me for whoever I was or was going to become or was not going to become, you know. She just loved me.
Yeah.
It is so evidently clear now as an adult how much she loved me, you know. It's an amazing thing to see. And I can only hope that I will love someone that much. It's just a different kind of love.
Unqualified and unending. We're talking about you playing the cello. You really got into it. You liked it a lot. Talk about your development then. You went to an art school.
Yes.
Talk about then sort of how serious you were and at what point you decided you were going to be a classical cellist.
From my very first lesson, I was going to be a classical cellist. I had no idea what that meant. Didn't realize the work that it was going to require, but I loved it, and that's what I wanted to be. But my teacher was very good about pushing us to, you know, greater extents constantly, you know, just get incrementally better, little by little, practice harder, little by little, starting off with, you know, 10 minutes a day working up to 3 hours a day was kind of the whole point. And when I was 15, she started to see that the area, High Point, didn't have what it needed for me to continue playing classically. We didn't have an orchestra in our high school. I was playing with a Greensboro Symphony Youth Orchestra, but she wanted to see me go out and play on kind of a larger stage. And ended up going to Idlewild Arts Academy at 16 with some reluctance from my parents, obviously, because I was leaving the house. And I was the baby boy, you know.
All the way out to California.
The way out to California, which I chose. It was going to be either Interlochen in Michigan or Idlewild Arts Academy in California. And I was like, well, which one's farther away from home?
One has better weather?
Which one has Yeah.
So you're out there, and you sort of right away you met with some early success.
Which was probably not the greatest thing for me. A 16-year-old with an ego bigger than my ego now was probably a bad thing. And it was only helped along when I got seated principal cellist as a new student at the school.
Mm-hmm.
Looking back on it, I really wish they just sat me at the end of the section so I could work my way up.
So you thought you had it all.
I thought
nothing
I was
left
hot.
To work
yeah,
for.
I thought
right?
I was hot stuff, you know.
Yeah.
Like, I went in there and I was like, oh, man, I'm at this art school and I hit first cello just off the bat. I'm hot stuff, you know. And obviously that is not true. But when you
So what there, happened? When you then you tried to get into some – you're talking about the high school level now.
High school level, yeah.
So now you're going to get into – you want to get into some of the top
Sure.
colleges.
And that's what the school was. It was a big – preparatory school that fed, you know, Juilliard, Curtis, Eastman School of Music, Oberlin, University of Southern California, had an amazing music program, still does today. And because I had kind of been told via action that I was all so great, I did not work, you know. I slacked off.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone else around me got better and better. And I stayed the same, you know, and I needed to get better in order to go to conservatory. I was kind of just going on natural talent at that point, just thinking natural talent can carry me on. And obviously, I did not have that much natural talent.
Well, you had natural talent that had to be developed. You recognize
did.
That
yes.
now. And if you just let it sit there, it won't get any better. So it didn't. And you didn't get into any of those schools.
I did not get into any of my top choice schools or any music school that I had wanted to go to and had to settle, quote unquote, for UNC. And UNC was the last place I wanted to go because my whole family went to UNC. And I never wanted to be like everyone else in the family because I was, always a little punk.
and the greatest cellist in the entire family, as far as you can tell.
The only,
So you go to UNC and actually took computer science?
It took me a couple years to get there just because I was confused. I was a music major for a couple years and really just a defeated music major. I was like, I'm just going through the motions at this point. And,
so what were you feeling? Again, when you get that last rejection letter at Idlewild, I mean, what's going through your mind?
I think that the last, 12 years of my life, 9 years of my life have just been wasted. Mm. All the hard work, all the practicing is just gone. I'm like, why? What did I do? You know, what am I doing? What am I going to do? All these questions. As any 18-year-old who thinks that they have to have their life planned for the rest of their life when they enter college is thinking, it was terrifying and sad and in a very dark, dark time in my life because, I wanted to be a musician as long as I can remember. And then I realized I had to do something to eat and I was not going to be a doctor or a lawyer like my parents wanted me to be. And I decided to give computer science a try. You know, a lot of the students in the department were music majors as well, minors, because we couldn't double major back then. But and I was like, oh, well, if they're all in computer science, I can probably do computer science. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and she just decided to declare my major.
Right.
And I,
you can at least eat because computers, they're going to be around.
There's always going to be computers.
You meet a friend, Leon.
Yeah.
Tell us about his effort and I guess his help in getting you back to the instrument.
Yeah. So Leon was one of the first people I met at UNC through climbing club, you know, which is the best thing that any musician should do is go climbing. But he was just one of the more positive people that you could meet, you know, in terms of just you don't need to be a famous musician to play music. You don't need to be, you know, playing for thousands of people because you have music in your life, you know, and that was always the thing. He grew up with music in his life. His dad was really big into Neil Young, and I had no idea who Neil Young was. And this is in college, you know, yeah. where I'm discovering Neil Young. Like, holy smokes, you know. And he made me play again because he's like, you can't just throw that away. You love it, you know, and he made me play
with
him.
How long do you think it was? I mean, how long did you actually put the cello away, just not pick it up? Was there ever a time when you weren't just...
Yeah, I mean, when I stopped practicing, right. I guess, is when I put it away, which would have been when my freshman year of college. Mm-hmm. It no longer became the focal point in my life, mm-hmm. which... That was scary.
Pretty disorienting.
That's the only thing I knew as the focal point in my life, yeah.
I would not recommend rock climbing, actually, with that level of disorientation, but apparently you did it and survived, and we're all happy. Somehow. We're all happy it worked out. Yeah. So you get back into music in what way? Were you just sort of practicing on your own? Did you get together with other band members?
I was not practicing on my own, but more playing for my friends and roommates who would who'd be like, hey, play us a piece. You know, you've been playing for so long, and you've played for Yo-Yo Ma, and you've obviously done something right, you know, and just playing in the house. And then that ended up being playing with Leon, because he's very forceful when it comes to realizing that you've given your life to music and you can't improvise. Mm. It's like, well, that's just...
Wait, you know? you were saying you can't improvise.
I can't do it. No, there's no way.
This stuff is pretty well, it's laid out. We have something called music.
Yeah, it's structured.
It's score. You know? So you think you can't improvise. He says you're crazy. If you know how to play, you can improvise. When was your first, when did he prove you wrong?
Still hasn't proven me wrong. Absolutely. I win on that one.
No. You form a band, right? Big Pretty and the Red Rockets. Yeah. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so that was a product of Leon and forcing me to play outside the box. You know, don't look at there are no notes, so you have nothing to look at. You understand music, so you can play. And that was what it came down to. And he would just play guitar. And then he and his longtime childhood friend who had just moved from Wilmington, we would just play together. And Lucas was this freestyling, politically minded lyricist, you know, and Leon was a songwriter, a guitar player, harmonica player, picked up any instrument and played it kind of guy. And it was inspiring, you know, just to play with them because it was fun. Mm-hmm. And that's what it came down to, is it was fun. So that was Big Pretty. Or sorry, that was the Red Rockets. And this is not like a gross thing, because the Red Rocket was like a radio flyer.
It's a wagon. Yeah.
That's what they called it. So,
that's the Red Rockets. When how does Big Pretty enter the picture?
So after many months of just playing out in bars, because somehow people wanted to hear us play for some reason, we ran into a local bartender / ex-defensive lineman for true starting freshman from Michigan University, Jake Freisinger.
So wait, we've got a guitarist and a cellist meeting a linebacker from Michigan, Michigan State, and they're going to form a band.
Yeah. Well, we met him, and he was this soft-hearted, love song writing, amazing guitarist, you know, and I was like, oh, of course we should be playing with this guy, because he'll kill us if we don't. You know? No, and that was it. You know, we met him, and he was going by Big Pretty because he was big, and he had a cellist who was pretty, which was Big Pretty. You know? So that's all it was.
So you start playing together, and how'd that go? But then you mentioned something about a politically minded songwriter in the Rockets, and that's where the trouble started.
So we started to have some kind of butting of heads between Lucas and Jake. Lucas felt like music was always, he was big into reggae, and music was a platform for politics and political views and kind of spreading the knowledge of what's going on. And Jake was of the mind that music is for enjoyment, and it's for getting people away from these things that are heavy and weighted. Both of those are very valid points, you know. And there came a day where that just wasn't going to happen anymore. And so Jake ended up leaving. He ended up leaving town altogether. He ended up moving back to Michigan, yeah, where he was from. And we could no longer be called Big Brain Third Rockets, and at that point went by Bus.
You changed your name to Bus?
Bus. We had a bus.
could have been the Red Rockets. So, all right. The craziest story I've ever heard. So you're still a band?
Still a band.
Are you still, by the way, consulting?
I'm still consulting at IBM at this point.
All right.
But shortly thereafter, was about to leave. My department, I guess, at IBM was being restructured into a different part of IBM, and I was offered to apply for other departments or take a severance, and I missed music, and I enjoyed doing these things with my buddies, and so I took the severance.
Severance. Now you can concentrate on music, and no story about Music in the Triangle can be told without somehow Spanky's being entering the picture. So Spanky's is part of this.
Spanky's is definitely part of the story. Yeah. It is, Leon was working at Spanky's, and I no longer had an income and had to, you know, I had a house and no income. These things do not go hand in hand, by the way. You don't own a house without having a way of paying for your house. And Leon got me a job at Spanky's, and I just worked my way up to bartender over years of working there. And that was the perfect job for any musician, right? Because you can leave when you want. You can go on tour with your band. And
you can lay claim to poverty,
which is important
for a musician.
Very important to a musician. You got to get hungry, right? You got to get hungry.
Talking to Joe Kwan today on The State of Things. And leading up to how you met the Avid Brothers, this is this period in which you're really very, very free, and it's precarious, of course, financially. Mm-hmm. Tell us how that connection got made.
Well, let's see. This would have been 2006. Our band, Bus, was playing in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, the same day that the Avett Brothers were playing in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, for a festival in downtown Winston-Salem. We were playing at a small club called Rubber Soul, and we looked at the little independent Village Voice. I don't know what it was called. Oh, and there's the Avett Brothers. They're playing. That's awesome. We're going to have no one at our gig. let's go watch them, you know. And that was my first experience seeing them live, you know. And it was amazing. Their energy pours off stage as soon as you see them. I don't know if you've ever.
Oh yeah, no, it's amazing. And you think, how long can they keep going on?
Right.
And it's been a long time.
It's infectious. You know?
Yeah,
you just want to do that. I remembered one of our band members was like, "They look like the Muppets." I was like, "Yes, that's so amazing. That's exactly it."
Yeah.
And that was the day that I met Bob Crawford. He, with much reluctance, was asked to come out after their gig.
You, by the way, you're so poor that actually are not really buying a ticket.
Oh, no,
like the $5 ticket to get in, right?
No, we were not even considering buying the $5 ticket, you know. We can stand on this side of a 4-foot gate and look at the band and watch them and be $5 richer.
Yeah, there you go.
And so, that's what we did. Sorry. Guys.
You've made up for it since. And tell us about that, how you come to the attention of Bob Crawford, who plays bass.
Yeah, so after their gig, he had some friends in Winston-Salem that were like, "Oh, you got to come out, you know," and he was like, "Ah, I don't want to really go out. I just played a show." And like, "Oh, we promise there's this bar called Rubber Soul. No one ever goes there." And of course, that's where we're playing. And I was like, all right, I'll go, you know. It's known to have local bands playing, and so he just came out, and he walked in the door, and Leon like nudges me, and he's like, "Hey," you know, kind of gives me the head nod, like, "Check out who it is." I'm like, "Oh my God, that's Bob from the Avid Brothers," you know. And he stuck around for our second set, which ended at like 2 a.m. probably, because that's what you did as a young band. And he came up to us right away, just And if you've ever met Bob, he's a very excited person. Mm-hmm. Like, especially if it's something that he's really into, you can see it on him. Mm-hmm. And I've known that more and more through the years. And he's just like, this is amazing. You guys are so great. I'd love it. You know, I've got this little side project. It's called New Jersey Transient, and it's more jazz influenced. And I'd love it if you know, some part of y'all could come and play with me and work on an album together. And just, we ended up, you know, we're like, well, that's kind of a silly question. Of course we're going to say yes, you know.
So you didn't do some crazy thing like, well, let me check my schedule. Manager. Yeah. I'm not sure what we're doing through 2016. Didn't happen that way. Joe Kwan did meet up and go on tour, and we're going to talk about how that meeting with Bob Crawford and his side project worked into a gig with the Avett Brothers when our conversation with Joe Kwan continues in a moment. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio, talking with Joe Kwan today, cellist with the Avett Brothers. He's got quite an exuberant performing style as a cellist. He jumps around on that stage and does not stay put in his seat the way a good cellist is supposed to. He shows you a good cellist can actually stand up and jump around, and proves it every time he plays with the Avett Brothers. Been touring since 2007, based in Raleigh when he's not on tour, and here with us on The State of Things. So you talked about being with Bob Crawford. He had a side project, heard you as the bus playing in High Point with another band, wanted you to work on that side project. You did. How does that turn into a gig with the Avett Brothers?
Luck? I don't know. Bob has a lot of... is one-third of the Avett Brothers. Yeah. And so he I believe, asked the guys if New Jersey Transient could open for the Avett Brothers in Rocky Mount, North Carolina. And, of course, you know, that was the case. And it was very much by chance that I even met him, and this was even greater because now, you know, we were getting to a point where we're going to be able to play in front of people for the first time, especially Leon and Ingrid and I, who've never played in front of a large group before. Ingrid was our accordion player, multi-talented singer, musician. And so that day came, and we played for, must have been 1,400, 2,000 people in Rocky Mount, North Carolina, and it just happened to be right around the time that they were recording Emotionalism, which is still to this day one of my favorite albums. It's amazing. Which I think I'm okay to say that, right?
Yeah, no, you are. You get to say that. And there's a lot of people out there who agree with you.
Yeah,
and then they'll say, no, I've got other favorite.
Sure. Yeah, and after New Jersey Transient opened, you know, I came backstage and Scott and Seth approached me, and they said, hey, we're looking for a cellist to record a couple tracks on Emotionalism. Would you consider coming to Asheville, you know, on this date and putting down a couple tracks? I said, oh, yeah, let me think about that. You know, another moment.
Well
of,
done.
Yeah. No, it was instant.
I want to play. Here's a little bit of Salina, where you'll hear Joe Kwan playing with the Avett Brothers from that album, Emotionalism.
Tipsy, hang up the telephone. I won't answer your phone calls no more. New York, quit calling. New York, leave me be. I'm changing the plans that I've been setting on. I'm scared by the way that my life's getting gone. Carolina, one day someday I'll come home. Carolina, one day someday I'll come home.
That's a clip of the Avid Brothers song Salina featuring cellist Joe Kwan, who is my guest today on The State of Things. What was it like recording that album?
It's crazy to even hear that album version because it brings me right back to it. You know, it was a neat experience for me because it was the first time that the Avits had actually hired a producer in terms of like a full studio experience. They got Bill Reynolds from Band of Horses, and at that time it was Donna the Buffalo, I believe, the bass player, to come co-produce with Denny Kador. And so it was, a studio session, and it was exciting. You know, I'd never been in a studio as a cellist. It's not something that I would have ever thought would happen. You know, I thought I was going to play in an orchestra. I was going to go play solo on, you know, stage somewhere.
Were you all playing together? Was there a lot of multi-track?
This one was, the experience was amazing because I remember very vividly, Seth was sitting in front of me. They played me the track and I'm like, we're trying to go for this feel here and just something very expansive and multi-layered string part. Sounds like a quartet and just go with it, you know, and that was it.
You had to improvise.
Yeah, I had to figure it out. fake it till you make it. And that was the...
How much of a sense of the Avett brothers did you have? Because this had to be a different experience for them, too. You said they hire a producer, they're looking for a string sound. I mean, they had developed a sound and a following. They'd recorded, I think, 4 albums up until that point or so.
At least.
Right, and they've got a sound, they've got a following. So for them, this is a new experience. It's new terrain as well. And you, how much did you know about the Avett brothers and how much of that knowledge did you bring to your improvisation at that moment? And how much of it was just, look, this is what I'm listening to. I'm responding to this track.
I knew very little about them. I only knew them from an outsider's point of view. I knew that they had high energy and that their live shows were crazy. I didn't have any of their albums, you know. Wow. And so I didn't know about their ballads. I didn't know anything. And so this was a very far departure from that.
Yeah. So you laid down that track and were part of Emotionalism. That's the studio set. Then they ask you to play a New Year's Eve gig, right?
Yeah. I believe that was in October that we were in Asheville recording that. Or maybe it was sooner. The album came out.
Same year, though.
Same year, yeah.
That they're going to
ask. That was in October, yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, they were playing 2 New Year's shows, one on December 30th, 2006. In Raleigh at Lincoln Theater, I believe. And they said, hey, you know, Bob called. Bob was always the guy because Bob brought me into the fold. So Bob called and he said, Joe, hey, man, we're playing in your neck of the woods for New Year's. You want to come and play those songs? And I was like, oh, my God, this is crazy. Of course. Yes, I would love to play a live show with y'all. I believe the first... I could be.
But this means you're going to have to call. Forgive me for interrupting, but now you will have to call in sick at Spanky's. Usually big night, so it's a tough call.
My relationship with Spanky's was such that they loved my absence, I think. terrible server, bartender.
I see. You're definitely
please
not gonna
leave.
Have that. All right. So you're going to do this thing. And this is now, but again, very different from a studio session. Now
very
you're
different.
Actually going to be, and this is a band that's well known for its high energy antics on stage. Yeah. And there you are on stage, sitting in your little chair with your cello.
Not even a chair. I was sitting on Scott's amp because that's what was available.
Uh-huh.
I sat for 20 seconds probably. And the guys are they're jumping all over the place. They're going wild. And I'm playing like a cellist, sitting down with no energy. And I stood up and that was it. Yeah. Some chiropractor out there is going to make millions off of me one day because of that one decision.
What did that do though? I mean, there's a reason cellists sit. It's nice to have, it's big. It's not a fiddle. You can't tuck it under your chin. So when you dance with that thing, it does seem to wiggle a bit and to try to control it and play. How was your playing that? It's got to be hard to do.
My playing wasn't good to start with, so this only made it worse. Yeah. It was something that I was taught a long time ago at a summer camp at Interlochen. I had a friend, fellow cellist, who was an amazing cellist, and she's now still doing some great work. she was walking down the little alleyway at Interlaken with the cello tucked behind her head and playing like her part in a quartet she was working on. I was like, oh, yeah, that's really cool, you know? And in the back of my head, it was just tucked for years and years and years. And that was like the moment when I was playing with the Avids. I was like, I remember that time that Clarice Jensen put that cello behind her neck and she walked around with it.
Trudging through the snow at Interlaken. Yeah. So now you've played this New Year's. You've done a record. There's a one-off, or I guess two, New Year's Eve gigs, and now you're back to
Spankies.
Back to Spankies, right? How are you feeling?
You know, I'm still riding that high for a while. Yeah. Spankies had notoriously bad Tuesday night bar shifts, and this is kind of the darkest point in my young life at that point, and it was a Tuesday terrible bartending shift. I probably made $20. I was in a bad place mentally because I, you know, was questioning my decision to go back down this road of playing music. Mm-hmm. And I walked into the parking deck and got to my car, and the parking deck costs $6 to park. So there goes my paycheck, $20. I just sat there in my car, you know, and just kind of put my head down and was just like, what is going on? You know, I can't believe that this is where I'm gonna, yeah, you know, the direction I'm going. And at that time, we weren't allowed to use our cell phones, you know. So I clicked my cell phone on, my little Nokia, tiny little, yeah, you know, phone. No, nothing, doesn't say anything. It just says, you have 4 voice messages. And I remember 4 voice messages for some reason. And I listened to the first voice message, and it was Bob. And he said, you know, Joe, we really liked having you at New Year's, and we're looking for someone to help us out on the road, and we would love it if you would come out and tour with us. And that was it. Worst night ever turned to life-changing event.
Best night ever. And yeah, since then, you've been recording with them ever since. You've now recorded 4 albums. And I want to listen to a clip here. This is Through My Prayers. This is a song from the album. What? This is from Carpenter, right?
I believe so.
Yeah, this is from Carpenter, Through My Prayers. Let's listen to this clip.
To believe I won't see you again. We were just fighting when winter began. The coldness of our words competing with the wind from the north. Still they make me shiver, but in a very different way. The pages of the calendar kept turning away. I have some better words now, but it's too late to say them to you.
There it is, Joe Kwan playing with the Avid Brothers, as he does regularly now, and my guest on The State of Things. What's your role now with musically? How do you work with the band, and how does having a cello, do you think, change the band? How much influence do you have?
You know, my role with them has changed so much throughout the years. I started off playing a couple songs a show, and they're notorious for playing these long sets because they have a lot of songs to play. And I would be guitar teching, changing strings, loading in, loading out, you know, booking our hotels, booking our flights, whatever I could do to make myself more marketable to the Avid Brothers. Because I was like, I want to do this, you know, for the long run. I want to do it. And I would just say yes to anything that they needed help with. Yes, I'll do that. Yeah, I'll make gift baskets for the band. Yeah, okay. I'll make these phone calls, you know. And I still, to this day, still do some of those jobs, yeah, because, I don't know, I'm good at certain things.
Yeah, but and, musically, you have become, yeah, more important to the band.
Well, yeah, I don't, yeah, I guess. It's become this thing where I've grown with the band without me realizing that was happening, you know, like I, very much undervalued what I was doing, as just, you know, these are just logistics, and this is the just what I've been doing. And that's very much a classical mindset, I guess, which is kind of like, never good enough, never good enough. Mm. And so I did bring a softness to the band, right? Because the music obviously was getting very spacious because of the amount of spacious instruments that were there.
Yeah.
Rhythmically, you know, by bringing in a cellist, now you've got something that can sustain, you know,
right.
A guitar, a banjo cannot sustain, an upright bass that is pitched cannot sustain.
Yeah.
So now we have a sound that is filled with gaps, you know, the gaps are filled.
And no loss of energy, and certainly a great increase, I think, in musical interest. I think it gets more interesting without losing, I think, the character of the band. And among those many things you did was kind of do advance work on the food. And so it takes you right back to your childhood where food played such an important part. And now your food blog is as important and as popular as the band, I think.
I don't know about that. But it was a big part. And it really came out of necessity, the whole food thing. The guys have always been, they eat for sustenance, you know? Whereas I ate to be happy. And so I was able to bring that aspect to the band, you know, hey, let's not go and eat burritos today. Let's try this Thai restaurant that I heard is really good in this town. Let's go get these, you know, these burgers from this place that's supposed to have the best burgers in town, you know, whatever the case was. I started seeking it out, more out of a selfish, you know, out of a selfish place, because I wanted to eat well.
You got a blog now, and people are following that, so they pay attention to where the Avid Brothers are and where they eat.
Yeah, which is kind of fun.
Would you eat? And also, I think, gets to some of the, I've only got about 30 seconds left here, but you talked about this, the fact that it is a high-energy act, and you've got to pay attention to your health, sleep and food, all those things kind of matter on the road.
Very much so. Yeah, it's come to a point where we have to watch what we eat, you know, just because you don't want to go on stage with a belly full of macaroni and cheese.
No. That's what I say every day. I told my kids that growing up, and none of them became musicians for that very reason. Joe, what a pleasure. Thank you so much for talking.
Thank you, Frank.
Joe Kwan is a cellist. He is with the Avett Brothers. He's going to be playing with the Avett Brothers. Been doing that since 2006, featured on the band's four most recent albums. His blog is called Taste on Tour, and you can find out details about all of that, what they're doing next, what their next album is, and you know, a little bit more about that blog at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Will Michaels, Charlie Shelton, and Andrew Tai. Robin Copley is our technical director. Brent Wolf, WUNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.